Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Division 7 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. We have only one argument scheduled for this afternoon. That is the case of Heyman Contractors Incorporated against Carter and Burgess Incorporated and Craig Kitzman. I see the counselor set up. You may proceed with your argument.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Jesse Witt for Appellant Heyman Contractors. We'll proceed directly to argument and address the threshold question here, whether a contractor who's been defrauded out of over $400,000 in earnings is entitled to have a day in court, or whether the trial court here was correct in throwing out Heyman's claims without discovery or trial, based on its conclusion that the economic loss rule would be an absolute bar for fraud claims or to any liability for fraud committed after the execution of a contract. As the Supreme Court held in its seminal Town of Alma decision, any inquiry into the economic loss rule begins with focus on the duty that the defendant allegedly breached. If that duty exists only because of contract, then the plaintiff is limited to contract remedies. However, if that duty would exist independent of a contract, then the plaintiff may recover in tort. Under this analysis, intentional torts such as fraud are beyond the scope of the rule. The Town of Alma decision therefore distinguished prior cases such as Brody versus Bach, Supreme Court decision from Colorado, as well as the Formosa Plastics case from Texas, which presents very similar facts to the instant case. Now here, Carter and Burgess, or C&B, has argued that Brody was limited to fraud in the inducement, and that any fraud that C&B committed after signing its contract is thus safe. Well, that's not correct. In Brody, the Supreme Court withdrew its grant of certiorari as to the fraud in the inducement claim and decided the case as one for common law fraud. In that decision, it then ruled that even though the contract claims and the alleged fraud claims were based on the same fundamental representation, the issue there was the source of the duty, not the time of the breach. And this is made more clear in cases such as the Robinson Helicopter decision from California, which very clearly allowed the party to recover for fraudulently providing false information during the performance of a contract.
Counsel, is it your position that whenever there's fraud in the performance, that's an independent duty and we're outside the economic loss rule?
Essentially, yes. That's what the Supreme Court has held. That's what other courts have ruled. It's a separate duty that goes beyond what's simply required in the contract. As such, the economic loss rule simply doesn't apply to that, as the Supreme Court noted in Town of Alma.
Well, don't you need to look at what the duty is that's laid out in the contract itself?
You do, and that's certainly relevant in cases where the courts have looked to determine whether there was a contract or a negligence duty, for example, such as in the Grinberg case, Webb versus Desert Seed. They've gone through an analysis of factors such as that. Here, there was not a comparable duty. The contract, in general, recites the obligations of the parties, but it didn't address the situation where one party would go be outside the contract and start helping one of the city employees to lie and defraud the contractor.
Well, your fraud claim here, if I understand it, and please correct me, is essentially the fraud in the performance claim, is that these guys knew that there was a drainage issue. They didn't tell your client about it, and to the contrary, they're basically saying it's your client's fault and the delays are on your client. So essentially, they hid facts from you, is your claim, that allowed them to blame your client for the delay and also deny change orders. Is that fair?
That's essentially correct. There were also fraudulent inducement issues as to Kitzman, but that's essentially correct as to C&B.
Sure. Now, essentially the claim is by, you know, acting badly, they denied your change order and attributed delay damages to you, but you have a contract remedy here against the city.
Well, not entirely. To address that, first off, this is not those areas where the charges just described are all beyond the scope of CNB's contract. In fact, some of those areas were specifically excluded, such as quality control and dealings with where they had to go back to the original designer. To get to your question of whether there is a specific remedy, there is not. Heyman has some contractual claims against the city of Lewisville. However, it does not have any claim for its consequential damages and other results or losses that it suffered here as set forth in the affidavits it submitted to the trial court for losses on other jobs, damages that flowed from not from a breach of contract, but from deliberate fraudulent behavior.
Did it make any claim for any non-economic damages?
I don't recall if it made one specifically for non-economic damages, but it definitely made a claim for losses suffered on other projects due to the problems that it encountered here, which it later found were the result of deliberate misinformation.
And I don't mean to monopolize your time, but one more question. So why wouldn't, let's assume you have those kind of damages, losses elsewhere, wouldn't those under just traditional contract principles be consequential or incidental damages?
I believe it goes back to the question of duty. The courts have been clear with the economic loss rule decisions that the first step there is to look at where the duty arises. And if it's an independent duty, such as a duty to refrain from fraud, that there is a proper tort claim. The courts have not taken the step to say that any claim that could be included in the contract would be barred. And I think that ultimately gets to a policy sort of argument that whereas parties can allocate certain risks in their contract, they can allow for even negligent misrepresentations, as was discussed in the BRW case, it's expecting too much for the parties to anticipate that the other side is going to deliberately lie, deliberately provide false information. At that point, you're no longer enforcing the expectancy interests of the parties, which is really the policy that the economic loss rule serves. At that point, you're really just shielding a party from fraud, and the independent duties that exist at law do provide a remedy there. Now, as we noted in the briefs, we believe that's upheld by the cases such as Robinson Helicopter and the Formosa Plastics, which describes a very similar scheme to what Hammond alleged Kitzman did here. CNB has cited a list of federal cases that supposedly go in a different direction. As we noted again in our brief, the court can locate or review those published and unpublished decisions. A lot of them don't stand for that. And to the extent they do support CNB's argument, they're plainly at odds with Colorado law as stated in Town of Alma, Brody, and most recently in the Rhino Fund case. And the Rhino Fund, decided by Division One, is particularly instructive as it deals entirely with intentional torts that were committed after the execution of a contract. It actually went back and modified the opinion to make clear that there was no fraudulent inducement alleged. And they again stated that the economic loss rule did not apply because the defendant had independent duties in tort to avoid converting the funds that were issued in that case. The court also noted that the contractual remedies in the case were insufficient. And specifically, they noted that because the plaintiff's contract was with the corporate entity, it had no remedy against the individual. And that's really the exact same situation that Hammond is faced with here. Hammond has a contract with the city. The city is statutorily immune from claims for fraud as a matter of legislative policy. And the Governmental Immunity Act makes clear that Hammond's only recourse for consequential damages and other losses resulting from the fraud is to pursue the individuals, such as Mr. Kitzman and such as CNB. Now, defendants have also argued that Hammond did not have evidence to support its allegations of fraud. However, with the way these motions were postured to the trial court, the court was required to accept Hammond's allegations as true, and there were clearly questions of fact on these issues. Hammond has never had an opportunity to develop its claims or present its evidence. The defendants have repeatedly cited the Trinity hearing as though it were a full trial on the merits. This was a very limited proceeding dealing with how the city was operating a particular section of pipe. It had nothing to do with the fraud allegations. And as the Supreme Court made clear in its Tidwell decision, it's error to make findings in an immunity hearing and then apply those beyond the immunity context to go out and actually try to decide causation and embrace the final ultimate liability issues based on nothing more than an immunity inquiry that's typically undertaken without discovery, as it was, or undertaken with limited discovery, as it was in this case.
Mr. Witt, you said something a minute ago that puzzled me. You said that the court had to assume the truth of the facts There's the 12B1 issue with Mr. Kitzman. Let's take that out for a minute. All the other issues were decided on summary judgment, were they not?
The C&B issues were decided on summary judgment, but their C&B did not submit any substantive evidence on the question of how it was acting or what the intent of its officers were. It submitted affidavits describing how they claimed that their duties were subsumed with contract. Hammond submitted counter affidavits. CMB's affidavits, first off, did not meet their burden of proof as to establishing the lack of a tribal issue on the question of intent. We believe that intent in general would be an inherently factual issue that should not be resolved on summary judgment. So as such, although it did arise on a Rule 56 motion, the trial court was still obligated in large part to treat Hammond's allegations as true, and the trial court was, of course, obligated to recognize the questions of fact that were there. I would finally just simply direct the court on this issue to footnote 23 in Kitzman's answer, where he specifically admitted that he didn't really need a hearing on the jurisdictional issue, but that he wanted to try and see if the trial court would throw the case out without discovery. We believe that was improper and that the trial court erred by going along with that tactic.
On Mr. Kitzman's motion, other than the 12B1 part, was also ultimately treated as a Rule 56, correct?
The court was not real clear. It ultimately, I believe, decided it as a 12B1. There's some references in the record to alternate treatment, but it appears to have decided the issue ultimately as one strictly on notice under a 12B1 standard.
Well, that was the 12B1 part, but then there was all the other issues where the court, it was teed up as a 12B5, as I recall. And then I think both sides submitted affidavits, and the court said he was going to treat it as a Rule 56. Am I misremembering?
I honestly don't recall, Your Honor. That was okay. Quite a few motions going back and forth.
Okay.
Finally, just to briefly address the issue of attorney's fees, although a fee award is, of course, discretionary, there must be some evidence in the record to support the trial court's conclusion, as the Supreme Court made clear in the Western United Realty case. Here, as a matter of law, Hammond's claims were not frivolous. At worst, Hammond failed to predict the expansion of the economic loss rule to preclude recovery for intentional torts. That's not frivolous as a matter of law, nor were the claims groundless. A claim is groundless if there's no facts introduced to trial to support it. Here, Hammond never had a chance to conduct discovery, never had a chance to present its evidence at trial. And even so, Hammond was able to offer some documentary evidence showing that Kitzman and C&B knew of design problems on this job but misrepresented their true nature. The trial court, however, ignored this, stated in its order that it was relying solely on the Trinity hearing, which dealt with unrelated issues. With that, I'll save my remaining time for rebuttal.
Certainly.
May it please the court, Robert Lichty, on behalf of Mr. Kitzman. I will respond to questions concerning the factual matters while Mr. Barton, representing Carter and Burgess, will respond to the legal questions, especially concerning the economic loss rule. We submit that this appeal for both defendants rises and falls on the finding that Hammond Contractors did not challenge on appeal, and that finding is in Judge Galinsky's order granting the attorney's fees, in which she said the claims were groundless because Hammond could present no evidence to support its allegations that the culverts were in fact inadequate. Affirmance is no more complicated than affirming this one factual finding concerning Hammond's injury. And I'm focusing this entire argument on injury. It has nothing to do with fraud, it has to do with the injury. The only possible issue is whether Hammond was given proper opportunity to present evidence to support its alleged injury. The argument may have been different if Hammond had been allowed to proceed on a general allegation of fraud, because then it would have been very complicated and we would have had to ferret out who did what during discovery. But that is not the case. Hammond's allegations were simple and direct and repeated some 49 times in the amended complaint. Hammond claimed that it was injured because the culverts lacked capacity. They were too small. Simple as that. That's the only issue from our point of view that the court needs to focus on. The trial court set a Trinity hearing regarding whether the city was operating the culverts at the time of this particular injury. Thus, Hammond was under the obligation to establish jurisdiction by showing when it was injured, that is, by showing that the culverts were too small, resulting in the injury. That's what Hammond had to show. This is not rocket science, because the culverts are big, and they had to show that the culverts were too small and there was water backing up. That was the allegation in their complaint.
Why did Hammond have to prove the merits of its claim to establish jurisdiction over the claim?
It did not have to establish merits. It only had to show...
You're equating proof. You're saying that proof was required that the culverts were inadequate.
No. All I'm saying is they needed to show injury. In order to establish jurisdiction, they needed to say that the city had control over the culverts at the time of the injury. So the underlying predicate for that is, okay, when was the injury?
The injury was when the change orders were denied or
The
way damages were imposed.
No, the injury was when the culverts backed up, and we're claiming they didn't back up, so there was no injury.
Sounds circular.
No, it's not circular.
Well, it doesn't sound like a jurisdictional question to me. You're arguing the merits of the case, not the jurisdiction over the merits.
No, we're saying that there is no jurisdiction over the case because the city did not have control over the culverts when they caused the injury. How do we know that? They didn't cause any injury. It's similar to this.
You're saying no jurisdiction because they lose on the merits.
It's not the merits. It's an underlying factual predicate to the merits.
Counsel, what are you relying on for this? I'm confused also.
Okay.
Can you cite me a statute or rule or something you're relying on for this jurisdictional argument?
Yeah, it's the Governmental Immunity Act. They have to show that the city had control over the water facility or sanitation facility at the time of the injury. That's how it reads. It's similar to this.
Well, Mr. Linke, I don't see any ruling by the trial court until we get to the attorney fees issue on what you're talking about. So there's no summary judgment on that issue of injury. There's no judgment on that issue.
It was a factual finding.
Well, it was a factual finding in the context of an attorney fees motion,
right?
Not a judgment of the court.
Right, but it still can be applied. It was a finding by the court. The court made this finding. The court established this fact. And that can be applied legally to whatever it can be applied legally to.
Isn't that inconsistent with Tidwell? Doesn't Tidwell specifically say it cannot be applied? What the findings at the Trinity hearing cannot be applied?
No, Tidwell was, in fact, Tidwell said all you can apply is whether or not this was a chase. So the underlying factual predicate can be applied, and that's what we have here, whether there was an injury. This is similar to, and the reason why it's hard to get your heads around this, it's similar to this type of a case. Let's say that a plaintiff claims that a driver was negligent because he was driving recklessly. And the plaintiff claims that this recklessness caused damages to his car. And he shows the car. There's damages to the car consistent with being run into by this reckless driver. But after discovery, the initial disclosures, in this case we had 4,000 pages of documents, but after the initial disclosures, the court determines that the plaintiff damaged the car when he backed out of his garage. We no longer have an injury resulting from the reckless driving of the other driver.
But there we're looking at the nature of what's claimed and not what's proved. You seem to be saying that you have to actually prove something rather than claim it to establish jurisdiction.
You have to
if I claim, as in Tidwell, that my damages occurred at a particular point and that establishes there isn't jurisdiction, that's one thing. But then to prove, I mean, you're saying that a party has to go beyond that and not just claim it, but then prove whatever their damages were to establish jurisdiction.
No, I'm not saying they have to prove damages. They simply have to establish the injury that they allege in order to establish jurisdiction. It's very precise. They don't have to prove anything in the sense of proving it in a trial sense, but they have to establish jurisdiction by establishing that this injury occurred. So this doesn't have any resemblance to the Tidwell case, because in Tidwell there was a hearing as to whether there was a pursuit or not. And then after the hearing, there was a summary judgment at which time the court said that as a matter of law, I'm not finding causation, even though the plaintiff was not allowed to put on evidence of causation in the hearing. And this was error because the plaintiff was not allowed to put on evidence of causation, number one, and also the issue was the wrong issue The Tidwell court said that the issue was, did the injuries result from the accident, the pursuit, as opposed to were the injuries caused by? So actually, Tidwell does apply in that sense, that they have to establish, plaintiff has to establish that the injuries resulted from the claim conduct. I see that my time is up, and I'm going to defer the rest of the time to co-counsel.
Thank you. Counsel, I'm sorry. Let me ask a question to me. Tell me why your client did not get notice under these letters.
Well, because the letters didn't at no time talked about the particular injury that became the subject of the complaint, that is the two small culverts.
You would agree that the notice requirement it has to be substantial compliance, correct? Not
yeah.
Strict compliance.
Yeah, but they had to say, they had to at least mention that the culverts were too small, and that's what caused all the problems.
Doesn't it do that when it talks about that Washington Group letter?
No.
Why not?
Because there's just a concern. They were talking about a concern. It was my client that wrote to Washington Group talking about the concern of the size of the culverts. Are they big enough?
And they're saying, that your client expressed concerns about the capacity.
Yeah.
And then they say in their notice, the city's failure to disclose that constitutes fraud. Why isn't that sufficient?
Because they were talking about the capacity for the 100-year flood. They weren't talking about the capacity of any water that may have fallen while Hammond was doing the construction. It's completely out of context. In other words, engineers always talk about worst case scenario. Is this capacity good enough for worst case scenario? And Washington Group said, okay, we'll look into it. And there actually were changes made. So this was not noticed to them of that, of the fact that these culverts are so small that during a regular rain that will happen during construction that they're gonna back up. It has nothing to do with that.
I guess I don't understand. I'm sorry I'm taking up time here, but this is important to me. It says, even though the city was aware the design for drainage was defective, the city failed to provide the Washington document to Hammond. City's failure to disclose this information constitutes fraud. Isn't that exactly the claim that they were making in this case against your client?
Well, what context do you want to be in? If we're talking about the context of the 100-year flood, the worst-case scenario.
It's a very broad statement. I don't think context is relevant.
Now we get back to Rule 9B. And when Judge Hale says you have to plead fraud with particularity, that was a whole problem at the beginning.
9B doesn't apply to the notice requirement. You just told me substantial compliance is enough.
No, it does apply, because if you're going to give notice regarding something that's not going to be part of your complaint.
Could you cite me a case that says 9B applies to the notice required under the Government Immunity Act?
No, we don't have that. But substantial compliance means you have to have substantial compliance with the claims brought. It can't be substantial compliance with claims that you can't bring. That doesn't make sense.
Thanks.
Good afternoon. I see that I have about 5 minutes. So, I appreciate the opportunity to address the court. I represent Carter and Burgess in this case, and I think a couple of things get kind of lost in the shuffle.
Counsel, who are you? Sorry.
Benson Barton on behalf of Carter and Burgess.
Thank you.
Number one, it's important to remember that Carter and Burgess did not design this project. Carter and Burgess just signed up to be a construction administrator. And when Judge Glowinski made the final orders that Hammond has appealed from in this case that we're here arguing about for Carter and Burgess, as I counted, I believe there's a fraudulent misrepresentation claim, a fraudulent concealment claim, both of which are restricted by the pleadings to post-contract conduct in 2004, which is adequately explained in Judge Glowinski's orders. Then there's a pre- and post-contract negligence claim, and I believe the post-contract claim for negligence has been abandoned by Hammond in its briefing, and a negligent misrepresentation claim based upon post-contract conduct, which has also been abandoned. And if I have time, I'll get to briefly discuss the groundless and vexatious ruling that the judge made. It seems like most of the time spent in the briefing, though, and some of the questions that Judge Gabriel had during the first session with Mr. Witt related to the fraud and the performance issue. And that seems to be an issue that's the most important, so I'll start with that. And what
Mr.
I would
say... Sorry to interrupt you, but I'd like your response to your opponent's citation of the Brody versus Bach case.
Okay, the Brody versus Bach.
And he is correct that in the footnote, the court said the fraud and the inducement claim was not before it. So how is that case distinguishable?
I would submit that Brody versus Bach is a very specific set of facts. relating to a relationship that went on between two gentlemen explained in the opinion over 13 years. And what, in that case, whether it's Brody or Bach, one of them agreed to amend his will to give the guy an inducement to stay on in some kind of employment capacity. So whether or not you label it a fraud in the inducement case, it was an intent or it was a promise to enter into a future transaction that it, by its very substance, I think equates to a fraudulent inducement case. Our case is really vastly different. And when you remember that Carter and Burgess didn't design the project and was only a construction overseer, and then you take a look at Carter and Burgess's duties under the contract, which are on page 44 of our brief summarized, I counted 40 separate paragraphs of duties and only a few exclusions. And what I found in the research that we did in our briefing is that the majority rule, which is also in Colorado per the Parr case and some of the other cases from the District Court of Colorado that we cited, is that when the fraudulent allegations are interwoven with the contractual duties, it's a call that the trial judge can make. So whether you call it fraud in the performance or you call it some kind of extra conduct or extra type of fraud, if the subject matter of that fraud that's alleged in the amended complaint that we have is interwoven with the contract, which it is in this case, then it's barred by the economic loss rule. I would submit, though, that you all do not even have to reach the ultimate decision about whether or not there's a bright line rule that fraud in the performance is barred by the economic loss rule or not. And the reason for that is because if you agree that there's no merit to the underlying allegation of the injury that Hammond allegedly suffered, which we contend there is no merit, it's absurd that a city and a national construction overseeing firm like Carter and Burgess would help implement and design a project they knew would fail, which is essentially the allegation. I mean, you guys can reverse this case, but we'll be back here in 2 years after we have a trial on the merits, because there was no fraud, and that's Carter and Burgess' basic position. But even if there was, the judge invited Hammond multiple times on at least 8 or 9 different occasions, through orders, through hearings, through direct questions, and said, you know, tell me what this fraud is. And all they could say was, the culvert's backed up. And then she said, tell me what the fraud is. 49 different times in their complaint, they say it, but it's not even mentioned one time in their appellate brief. So they had a chance to allege fraud, and that's where we get back to the 9B requirements. And they had a chance to allege it more specifically and more specifically, and they just couldn't do it. And when you get back to the judgment call about whether the fraud is interwoven with the contract, it clearly is. Carter Burgess had a duty to oversee the contract. It had a duty to oversee change orders. It had a duty to give Hammond extra days for delay or not. And all of those things are what they're saying is the gravamen of the fraud. So that's really our position, and it's all discussed in the cases from Parr, the District of Colorado cases that we cite, Florida, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Washington, Third Circuit, Eighth Circuit. It really is the majority rule. And so I would say that finally, you could rule that consistently with those cases as well and find that that is the majority rule nationwide, but you don't have to issue a bright line ruling about whether fraud in the performance is barred or not based on the facts of this case. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for both Kitzman and CNB have argued that this court can simply look at the finding of groundlessness and decide the whole case. That's not correct. This is a matter that's subject to de novo review. The mere fact that there was a separate ruling later that was discretionary does not deny Hammond the right to de novo review of the underlying dismissal orders. Moreover, the suggestion that Hammond has not appealed the finding of groundlessness is simply untenable under the record here. Hammond very directly has challenged those findings. It has appealed that. And Hammond has presented evidence as well, or directed the court to evidence in the record, what limited record we have, that there was in fact injury. Although Counsel for Kitzman keeps saying that there was no injury, the pipes never backed up, that's simply not true. CNB's witness at the Trinity hearing when they were trying to discuss this issue of what these pipes were doing and how they were being operated, he describes how they came to a standstill, or the job came to a standstill at one point because the pipes had backed up. There's no factual record on a lot of these issues, but from what we have to work with, I believe they clearly support Hammond's claim. Same holds true as to the Washington Group report. There were issues there. Hammond believes that it did raise concerns about how this project would perform during construction, not just under the 100-year flood. There's not a sufficient record to affirm on that grounds, on that ground. With regard to C&B, the question is really a simple one. It's whether a party who commits fraud on a job site can be liable, or when a party goes out beyond anything its contract requires and participates with another in an effort to try to fraudulently extract additional money from a contractor, does that give rise to a cause of action or not? And we believe that it clearly does. C&B cites to the Parr case, but that was distinguished in Rhino Fund as not applying to the situation because, as in Rhino Fund, there wasn't a complete remedy.
No, they were independent. Counsel, I'm sorry, I know you've got a few seconds left, but you just said they tried to extract money through fraud. You're talking about them charging you liquidated damages for the delay. That's what you're talking about?
That and also additional work. Perhaps money is the wrong word because there was additional work performed at no charge to correct some of these issues. And I think that gets into the point of whether the trial court's comment that why would they design this project when they knew, or put this project out to bid when they knew it would fail. Well, they didn't know the whole project would fail. They knew there were problems that would need to be corrected. And after the project was underway, they tried to get Hammond to, after having come in on a low bid that didn't allow for those issues, they tried to get Hammond to address those at its own expense. And we believe that was fraud, that was independent of the contracts, and that supports a cause of action, at least that merits a trial. If I could address the Tidwell, I see my time's expired.
Time has expired. Thank you, counsel. Okay, that concludes our argument in this case. Court thanks all counsel for their arguments.